You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Dave Fettig. Tonight, Annie Harview chats with Kat Weaver and Emily Bergslian about their work Uncommon Charm in this 1920s Gothic comedy. Bright young socialite Julia and shy Jewish magician Simon decide they are not beholden to their family's unhappy history. Together, they confront such horrors as murdered ghosts, alive children, magic philosophy, a milieu that slides far too easily into surrealist metaphor, and worst of all, serious adult conversation.
And I'm Liz Olds. Then in the last part of the hour, I speak with P. David Ebersole about his novel 99 Miles from L.A. Jonesing to quit his teaching gig, Frank jumps at the chance to implement his new girlfriend's scheme to steal the skimmed cash treasure from her marijuana business tycoon husband. Hiding out in Palm Springs, 99 miles from L.A., Frank and his other accomplice, Ramon, team up in more ways than one. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Annie Harview with Right on Radio, and I am so excited to be joined by the co-authors of Uncommon Charm, new novel out now, Kat Weaver and Emily Bergslian. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Annie.
Hi.
It's so good to have you here. For those who aren't familiar, Emily and Kat are local authors. They've lived in the Twin Cities for a while. And this is your first novel, right?
Novella, actually. And
well, so it's a very, very small novel. So, like, think novel and then think, like, half that size.
She can travel with you. She can go wherever you want to bring
her. Exactly.
She's slender. She's a slender
book. Chuck it into your pocket.
Yeah. So, could you summarize this little book for those who haven't read it yet?
Well, first of all, it's a historical fantasy set in 1925, and it comes from Neon Hemlock, which is a queer science fiction and fantasy press. It's about these two young folks, Simon and Julia, and Julia's mother, the most powerful magician in all of England. Simon's recently come to the house. He's sort of uneasy with these powers that he's experiencing, unusual events, sort of occasionally breaking the laws of physics. It's told from Julia's point of view, though.
So Julia is a 16-year-old almost socialite who has just been expelled from school. So yes, as Emily said, the novella is told from her point of view, first person. She is a very loud narrator for a very quiet book. But it is the story of Julia and Simon as they don't solve what's not a mystery.
It's hopefully perfectly apparent what's happening, but it's a great deal more about...
So it's not necessarily about learning, like, discovering family secrets so much as it is, like, the circumstances around how you explain to someone what they already know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it very much felt like a character book and like a personhood book rather than like a plot twists kind of book, you know?
It is very much, and I think we tend to that style of writing and that style of reading, both when it comes to fantasy, where it is unfortunately a little rarer, and to just general literature.
Yeah, like I've some folks have described it as more like slice of life, but then also the sort of style of fiction that we are, like, semi-doing a pastiche of is very much focused on the domestic side of just, like, exploring people's lives and circumstances. It's just there is also magic involved here.
Yeah.
The way we've explained it is it's a little bit like Nancy Mitford, if there was more surrealism.
So what was it like to write this book as a team?
Well, we've been writing together in one way or another since we were small, very
like,
small.
Like, we're talking preteens, almost.
We're in our 30s now.
just for some perspective, so like we've been writing together for more than half our lives.
Yes.
But also, more recently, We have like a tabletop gaming group where we play Dungeons and Dragons, so that has also influenced our, I guess, collaborative storytelling style. I think we've been doing collaborative storytelling since we were small. It is like, it is our primary form of creativity, yeah. I might say, and like interacting with stories is doing it with other people rather than just being like an author alone who like maybe asks for feedback and stuff, but who like is ultimately on their own responsible for mm-hmm. the story versus working with somebody else where we can like bat things between each other.
And you get a lot more of like the tension and the snap mm-hmm. between characters, and hopefully character is what really makes this work.
Yeah, so I mean the actual like nitty-gritty process of it is Emily and I would do like improv dialogue as we were making dinner.
Oh, cool.
And write that down and then refine it further.
Uh-huh. Kat's a very skilled line editor, and that's what she does. She's mm-hmm. an editor for Strange Horizons, the science fiction periodical. Mm-hmm. And so we'd just, we'd hammer out the dialogue, frame some prose around it. Generally, I'm the one coming up with, I think, the narrative choices.
Yeah, so a lot of the shape of the story is due to Emily, but then what I've done is I am the one who is mostly in charge of, like, editing and cohesion mm-hmm. to make it all sound like it is from the same first-person narrator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. As Kat said to me before, if it was Simon telling the story, it would be a completely different book, which is what you hope for, of course, when it comes to a first-person narrator, but
yeah.
Also it would be longer.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get to the narrator, because I think you made a really interesting choice with who you chose, but I also just want to touch on, you mentioned working out the dialogue verbally together, mm-hmm. like while cooking. Cool. So, digging a little more into the book and its world, the book was set in 1925, for those who haven't read it yet. Could you two tell me how you researched and kind of did the world building for the story?
So the thing is, first of all, our research was being obsessed with 19th century and interwar Britain uh-huh. for more than 15 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Long-term research.
So very, very, very long-term.
So a lot of it is just simply ambient research, although we do have some specific touch points that we have, like books that we can name.
Yeah, we're cribbing a lot from Nancy Mitford, of mm-hmm. course, mm-hmm. and I actually encountered the Mitfords through another fantasy author, Joe Walton, who wrote An Alternate History mm-hmm. Of the Second World War. We aren't taking many of the biographical details just because, oh my god, they're so distinctive and so weird. I don't think that we could do them justice. They are a novel in their own. But also just a feminine middlebrow fiction of the interwar era mm-hmm. in general. So Rose McCauley, Dodie Smith, Dorothy Sayers.
Even I would say E.M. Forster,
nice.
Who was an early 20th century gay author.
Yeah. It feels very immersive and built out. Like, it doesn't feel like you read a textbook or a couple books of history. Like, it feels like you have observed a lot of customs of the era and are able to synthesize them into your own thing.
It is my very great pride that the Brits who have read it have only had, one or two changes to issue.
yeah. So, I mean, we are writing in a pastiche of specifically upper-class British, like, very posh voice. Mm-hmm. And so, we are, of course, American, but we have had, you know, readers who are like native to London who have been like, well, actually, like, you know, you should, like, this would be phrased this way, or like, you should change this to this. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think it is just having read a lot of the fiction of the era mm-hmm. for such a long time.
Another thing that we've pulled from is traditions of Western esotericism and magic. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I think as many people have noticed, just because I think lots of people aren't familiar with the history of magic. We're thinking of it as a thing where you, like, wave a wand and say a word and something happens. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this book and in general, magical thought is used as a way of framing yourself.
In the book, there was a point where Simon, who is also Jewish, makes a comment about magic and faith feeling related to him. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be an interesting kind of different way, instead of like magic being kind of an artifice or a sleight of hand, being more of a kind of a force, a universe force.
It's also very personal, because we have another character, Julia's mother, Lady Aloysia, who conceives of magic. It's not religious, but yeah. Like her interpretation of magic has more to do with like her own experience of like mental illness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's every person who calls themselves a magician has a different, extremely personal way that they approach it.
Cool.
And I actually had something of an unusual experience myself writing this book, which is that I decided to convert. Because I had been living in Simon's head and I was trying to really genuinely think through what he was feeling and what he was doing. Mm-hmm. There were other more difficult circumstances at the time, but this was a big drive for me.
Mm-hmm. So Julia, the narrator, is an exceptional person, but she doesn't have the specific magic powers that Simon and Muv do. What went into your choice to tell this story from the quote-unquote non-magic person's eyes?
So originally, so the seeds of this story started long, long, long ago. Mm-hmm. But the seeds of this particular story started maybe like 5 or so years before we actually started writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of it was, it was like just part of the joke. So you have this idea like of this big powerful magic that warps reality, it like warps the world, changes the world, there's ghosts, and then you have a narrator who looks at all of that and says, oh, that just happens sometimes.
That's just what my mom's like.
Yeah, you know, whatever, it's not a big deal,
it's a minor inconvenience. Yeah, it's just how life is.
It does this neat trick, I think, of making the magic more explicable, where you don't have to be in the magician's head thinking all these very deep philosophical thoughts.
Uh-huh.
Which would be kind of boring, probably.
Yeah, it would.
But also, having, you know, them talking about magic philosophy from an outside observer's perspective, it also does kind of preserve the mystery of it.
Yes.
And so it's, Julia is making the choice not to be a magician.
Yeah.
Like, she has heard all of her mother's lectures, like, she knows that, you know, being a magician is not something that is an innate, inborn trait. It is something that you can choose to do, and she just looks at all of that and just like, oh, no thank you.
Yeah. She'd rather do sports.
That's right.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's important in its own way. You see the trope of inheritable magic all the time, and it's sort of its own rejoinder to this idea of, I suppose, like atavism, of
the like having an innate like giftedness, an innate special skill.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's really just like you can be predisposed to think a certain way, but it's more about the choices that you make.
A really quiet interrogation of these ideas of heritability. Just because Vladimir, Simon's father, he sees his magic as having derived from birthright. So he looks at Simon and he's like, oh, of course, you get this from me.
Mm-hmm.
But Simon never grew up with him in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So why is he manifesting this? Because he experiences the world in a really profound and unusual way.
Yeah.
Is the answer.
Yeah. Something I loved in this novel is how real all the family dynamics felt. There was the tension, the moments of humor, the cousin dynamics. And there were also the class dynamics that I found really interesting in the family and in the broader society. So how much in the society scope of the book did feeling true to life play into your discussion of these societal elements, or did it just kind of happen that way?
In the book, Simon, being a working class Jewish boy from London's East End, is suddenly thrust into this world of like really over the top libertine aristocrats.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about the aristocracy, it's like, so a lot of today's quote-unquote traditional thought about families and gender and etc., it does derive like really specifically from the 19th century and specifically Victorian morality. So that is still present today. Mm-hmm. The way people thought back then, it still continues now.
Mm-hmm.
So people in the 1920s, they were like really grappling with the end of an era. Mm-hmm. After World War I, there was a lot of reflection about that. And we are still sort of feeling the echoes of these various reactionary movements.
A lot of it, too, was personal. We were obsessed as teens with the Romanovs. I feel like everybody, well, no, not everybody, almost certainly. people who are obsessed with history and historical fiction have this little phase they go through where they just become enchanted with the Russian Empire. But you look at the reality of it beyond these stories of, oh, the poor Romanov girls and their tragic murder. These people were horrible.
So that's something that was at the top of our minds. But what feels relevant, or what could feel relevant today about the family dynamics, is simply that We live in a society. We are still dealing with the same things. None of these broader tensions were, like, we didn't consciously think about them. But, like, of course it's going to show up in the writing as we try to make characters whose interactions feel real.
And I also wanted to focus some on, like, the irregularity of experience even within certain categories. Like, Simon's mother, Ruta, and Simon himself, they experience being queer in very different ways. And how they relate to being queer and being Jewish is very different. Ruta was kicked out of her home. She was pregnant as a teen. She's a very, very outspoken atheist. A Jewish atheist, but an atheist. Whereas Simon relates very strongly to his faith. And I really didn't want to delve too much into what you see as like the typical faith and queerness story, which is like, oh, God hates me, because it's not that.
Yeah.
What a lot of people are experiencing and what Simon is experiencing is this fear that he's going to lose a community that is very important to him. So he is not concerned as to like his status in the eyes of the divine. He's worried about losing his way of life. If he's out.
To delve deeper into the conversation about queerness and compulsory heterosexuality in the book, I thought that was done in very interesting ways. The characters, as you mentioned, and several more are out as queer, but there's also this strong societal expectation of matchmaking and straight marriage. At one point, Julia narrates, "I would have to marry someone or other eventually," referring to, like, you know, getting latched to a man despite her own interests or desires. So tell me about the role you perceive queerness and sexuality playing in this society and these characters' lives.
So Emily already mentioned some of that from Simon's perspective. So most of the aristocratic characters, on the other hand, so thinking of Julia, Julia's mother, even Julia's gay cousin, they are, or at least they were, in Julia's mother's case, unable to imagine anything different. So for them, marriage is still just as much of a job for them as it is love. And, you know, even more than it being a job. It's a means of ensuring that their way of life continues and that the money stays with the right people or, you know, even in the family. So based on our research and our readings, queer people, you know, of varying levels of obviousness, they're tolerated if they adhere to these class expectations. So part of what Julia is starting to learn in the story is she doesn't have to do anything if she doesn't want to. She has more choices than her mother did.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, focusing some on how queerness was perceived then versus now. We think of it as this very, like, torrid Downton Abbey thing where it's just like, oh, I shall be cast out. Whereas the way that society thinks about queerness is completely different now. There's a big divide between, like, doing and being something.
Yeah.
It was starting to change over at that time.
So you have characters, you know, the characters in this book thinking, like, they don't think of queerness necessarily how we do. They would think, okay, well, what is the best way I can make a life out of this? What is the way I can have what I want, but still do what is expected of me?
Gotcha. That's so interesting. Continuing a little more conversation about Julia, I loved her as a narrator because she's insightful and great at describing others. She's got this good wry humor that kind of played into the pastiche kind of aspect that you were mentioning earlier, which was very fun. But we find her keeping issues and stressors at arm's length with this humor. And at one point she even mentions that she doesn't like to think about things that she can't make into a joke. And I think one of the strongest ways I saw in that, and I don't want to spoil this whole unraveling before people can read the book, but this ties neatly into how long it takes her to reveal why she got expelled from school and to kind of tell other personal details about herself. How did this trait of Julia's, this like kind of wry shield, play into your structuring of the story and pacing of how you reveal information?
So we have in the story, there's the whole quote-unquote main mystery, which, you know, it isn't really intended to be a surprise. It's what I think of as sort of a fairly typical and fairly, like, extremely well foreshadowed, like, gothic whole mess that happened 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's not personally close to Julia, so she and Simon can have that curiosity about it, and they can go digging for things. But being expelled from school is what's a little bit closer to Julia's heart, and the same with Simon. Like, the, you know, the magic that he's been experiencing that caused him to have to be taken on by Julia's mother as her apprentice. Like, he's sort of really shy about wanting to elucidate what the circumstances surrounding that were. So they put all their energy into exploring this cold case mystery versus actually thinking about what's most important in their lives currently.
It's also riffing a little bit, again, on the feminine middle brow literature, where, you know, we tend to think of this stuff as being very chick lit. And just because it is about the domestic sphere, it is about women's lives. But you read a lot of it, and it is profoundly about domestic disappointments and thwarted ambitions and that kind of thing. For example, the Radlett girls in Pursuit of Love by Nancy Mitford, Linda throws herself into love affairs because she has nothing else to do, which is just profoundly sad to me.
Yeah, so Julia's at this sort of loose end, having been expelled from school, and she's, you know, trying to figure out what is right in front of her face. Like, what is she going to do with her life? But also, the point at which Simon and Julia do end up being able to share these these not really secrets that they've been keeping from each other, mm-hmm. but the point at which they're able to be like, okay, so yeah, so this is what happened. Mm-hmm. That's like really when they cement their friendship with mm-hmm. each other. But it's also, the story is also about them learning to do that sort of on their own time. Mm-hmm. So the pacing of information from this main gothic mystery is, you know, echoed there. So a lot of it is about boundaries and choices. Mm-hmm. So speaking of, you know, different points of view, it would be a different story from Simon's point of view, but it'd also be a different story from Julia's mother's point of view. So yeah. from her point of view, you might get a more explicit question of, so when's the right time to tell my teenage daughter what happened 25 years ago? Mm-hmm. Is she mature enough to hear this? Does she even want to hear it? How will she take it? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the story is about these characters probing each other's boundaries mm-hmm. and wondering when to push each other's boundaries
yeah.
or when to let their own down.
At what point, she's thinking, am I going to lock my daughter in the car and tell her the saddest story she's ever heard in her entire life? Which I think is an experience many daughters with mothers have had.
Did you ever consider resolving it in a different way? Like, I felt like it was nice. To me, it felt like it resolved pleasantly, but not too overly rosily.
You know, I think it was always...
Yeah.
Going to have not an open ending, mm-hmm. but it, there's only so much you can do mm-hmm. when you are 16 years old.
Yeah.
And when it, you know, this main gothic mystery of what happened 25 years ago is related to you, but like, it's not your responsibility.
And a lot of that comes from, I think, our desire not to tell a fantasy story that is motivated by extremely dire stakes. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to take this object to this location or else the evil sorcerer will annihilate us all.
Which, to be fair, I enjoy.
Yes, I have read many a book among this line and enjoyed it greatly, but it's not what I want to write. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in personal stakes and mm-hmm. ones that are hard to resolve, mm-hmm. extremely difficult, because not wanting to speak too much about what happens, there is a dilemma that Simon and Julia more so, they're left with, mm-hmm. which is to tell their cousins about the history of their family and the horrible things that have happened. Do they want to share that, or do they want their cousins to go on just living without it in their lives?
And mm-hmm. it's a question that's not answered.
Yeah.
In the confines of the novella, and mm-hmm. I think that just felt more real and more human and more like something that an actual person
yeah.
might decide, more so than like telling an overarching story with a point and a plot and a moral. I mean, there is a moral here. It's just yeah. the moral is that there is no like best answer.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're doing, and I don't either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just have to go on living.
That's right.
And there's a certain part of coming of age that is knowing that everything won't be resolved now, mm-hmm. and that you have to continue working on relationships with people, and you have to continue learning more about your family dynamics and how to live within them and how to communicate well with others. And I think it's very realistic not to have that all solved when these characters aren't even 18 yet.
Hello, hello.
Yeah, David, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. Thanks for joining us on Right on Radio this evening. This is P. David Ebersole, author of 99 Miles from L.A., a hard-boiled crime story with a bisexual love triangle peppered with double crosses. So why don't we start with your reading?
Oh, sure. You know, the title comes from a Johnny Mathis song. And so as I read along here, you'll notice that that it gets referenced. So chapter one, he sings along when he drives. His voice won him awards when he was young, and it's far from unpleasant now, but he learned long ago that no one was going to pay him to be a professional musician in life. Still, he loves to sing. He holds the notes on the vowels because that's the way to sound good. He can't hold a consonant. In the car, he always tries to imagine an audience because it makes a difference. You sing better. The oncoming traffic becomes the blinding footlights in his mind's eye. The rain on the windshield stands in for that faint murmur of the crowd. The wet tires are cocktails being served. Even though you can't see the people, you look straight ahead and you sing outward at all of them and to each one of them simultaneously. He had those dreams, yes, but he's had a lot of dreams that did not come true. This current one, though, this one's going to work because it isn't a dream. It's a plan. And this is the very last part of it now. Everything else worked. All three of them have to do is come together, keep their heads, and not fight. He's pretty sure she's going to be mad because she was hit so hard, but it had to be done to make it look real. Ramon, though, Ramon will be glad to see him. He's damn sure of that. If he's there, he said he'd be there. 99 miles from L.A. He hums the words he doesn't know. She could also get mad because he was already planning to see Ramon without her being there anyway. She doesn't know about him and Ramon, so she can't be mad. Even if she is, who cares? He spent his whole life trying to please people. No more. He was supposed to drive to the desert tonight. Ramon will be out there too, but not at her Palm Springs house. They can't risk that any one of them has been followed. But who would follow them for 100 miles without picking one of them up? If the cops were onto them, they'd have stopped the car by now. And if her husband somehow figured it all out, he'd be dead before he hit the 111. 99 miles from L.A. You know why the movie stars all went to Palm Springs back in the day? According to local lore, they were salaried and under contract to the studios who wouldn't let them go further than 100 miles beyond the studio zone when they were engaged on a film so that they could be called back to set. He read all of this history right after she told him Palm Springs would be their getaway town.
That was David Ebersol, P. David Ebersol, reading from 99 Miles from L.A. Why don't you introduce us to our three protagonists?
Well, Frank is our main character, and he is a kind of disgruntled music professor at UCLA. He had dreams of being a singer, and now he's at his rope's end, kind of realizing that his life is going to go nowhere. And he's come to a place where, as he says, you know, he's pretty much ready to rob a bank. And he comes across Shelley, who is an unhappily married woman, always has been the smartest woman in the room. And she happens to be at the UCLA campus where Frank works because her dog is at death's door and she just couldn't pull the trigger. And so she decided to take the dog to the, you know, to the sculpture garden to have one sort of more moment in nature. But she's been looking for people to help her, get out of the situation that she's in. She has a favorite bartender named Ramon, who is where she goes to drink. Usually after she's taken her dog to the vet, and she's kind of tagged Ramon as one of her cohorts. And now when she comes upon Frank, she seems to have found the third that can help her pull off this crime. Her husband is a marijuana dealer, which is an all cash business. And he's been burying money in the backyard. And she has masterminded a plan to run away with the fortune. And that's our setup.
And Frank also knew Ramon before he met Shelley, or was it kind of a...
No, it's all pretty much been in Shelley's okay. Mind. They go to the bar after Frank helps her put her dog down that day. And that's the first time that he meets Ramon. But the two men have immediate sparks between them, even though Frank and Shelley have already kind of started up a bit of an affair with each other, and the two men just find themselves uncontrollably attracted to each other. And of course, once love gets in the way of reason, that's when everything starts to fall apart.
Talk a little bit about, 99 Miles from L.A. is one song that comes up, obviously, in the book. But it seems like there's a lot of other musical references, and I'm wondering what they might be and how they, throughout the story, kind of move the story along.
Well, because Frank is a music professor, and a lot of the story is told through his eyes, music is a really important part of kind of his life. And so one of the things that he references and talks about is how often pop music will kind of come along while something's going on in your life and has such resonance. And I think we've all kind of had those moments. You're breaking up with someone and you hear a song, or you're falling in love and you hear a song. And so he keeps kind of making reference to the music that he hears and how it is fitting in with this story that we're going through. So it comes up quite often throughout. And Ramon and Frank begin to kind of share almost a bit of a private language with their moments of kind of hearing music, and especially Johnny Mathis.
Now, I got to ask you, you're a screenwriter. Would you say you're primarily a screenwriter?
Well, I've really been a documentary filmmaker mm-hmm. for the last 11, 12 years. And I have done a lot of screenwriting and filmmaking. I mean, I'm a 58-year-old man, and I've been doing it since I was in college. I won Best Film at NYU when I was, a young pup, 23 years old.
All right.
And so it's really been my life. But I was an English major first at UCLA before I transferred to NYU Film School. So I made this kind of left turn at that moment and never really looked back. But my dream was always to be someone who had written a book. You know, a book on a bookshelf in a bookstore mm-hmm. Was to me the highest, the highest achievement.
With your name on the spine, right?
Exactly. You go along and it's like, E-A-E-B, and they pull it out, and you're like, there's Eversole.
There it is.
Well, it's a dream, It's
I relate completely. I'm a writer, too, and I dream of the spine and my name on the spine of the book.
Yeah.
As someone who's been a documentary filmmaker and a screenwriter, what prompted you, what inspired you to write a hard-boiled noir crime novel?
A lot of what I have written in my own writing of screenwriting has been kind of in the noir world. And so it was a natural for me to be looking to do that when I started to, move over to have this idea about writing a book. And my favorite writer of that world is Jim Thompson. Mm-hmm. I really like to follow the criminal much more than I like to follow, say, the detective trying to figure the story out. I find the criminals much more interesting. So as I was kind of dreaming up this story and looking for a way to kind of bring some reality to it, if three people are going to come together to steal money and they're trying to change their lives, it has to be a lot of money. And these days, where does that even happen? You're going to knock over a liquor store and what are you going to get? $10,000-$15,000 if you're lucky. So I ended up landing upon the pot business, the marijuana business, because it's an all cash business. And there was a rip from the headline story about a San Diego couple who were in the marijuana business, and their employees followed them home and they abused the woman and they stole all of the money that had been buried in the backyard. And I was like, aha, a cheery little rip from the headline story to help me write my book. So it was always a dream to take the time to write a book. And one of the things that I find difficult about writing for film is that you can't get inside anybody's head. You write what's on screen. You write dialogue, you write action, and you create a blueprint to either, even if it's yourself, to go and film it, but with all of these collaborators. When you write a book, it's all you. It's in your own head. And this intimate relationship between you and the reader. The reader will read these, you know, little black marks on white pages that are, you know, typed words, and they have to dream it all up. So it was just it was a whole new exercise of using talents that I maybe have honed in different ways over the years, but finally got to put in to this form I always wanted to do.
Do you have a preference at this point, or are you still learning what your preferences are?
Well, documentary film is kind of my career. It's what I do and what people are willing to pay me for. So it probably comes up again, and I'm sure that I will go back to it. But at the moment, what I'm going to do, I think, is take some time and invest into this new direction. So I'm going to try to write a couple more novels, I think. I think that's sort of my idea.
Talk some about your documentary.
All writing is interesting. All writing is really fun, really interesting to do. Like, I wouldn't say I have a preference, except for that I love to be in this world that I'm in right now, and it's new to me, so it's kind of exciting. Yeah.
Talk some about your documentaries, Hit So Hard, and My Name is Lopez is coming out soon, right?
My Name is Lopez is actually just out. So it's about Trini Lopez, who was a trailblazing Latino rocker. He came up in the 50s and into the 60s. He had a huge hit with If I Had a Hammer and Lemon Tree. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people know him from that. But really, you know, he kind of changed the world for Latino musicians, because before him, everybody was willing to change their name. And he said, no, I'm Mexican. I'm proud of it. This is my heritage. And he was turning down record deals because of it. So his friend, you know, Richard Valenzuela changed his name, right? The Hikar changed her name. Everybody had to kind of fit in with what somebody's idea was of what could be a star in America. And he said, it could be different. Why can't I be who I truly am? So he made a huge difference in the recording industry. And we knew him because he lived in Palm Springs, where we live. And he just, you know, happened to be gigging and playing a lot with neighbor friends of ours who offered to produce the documentary if we would make it. And so we were in the middle of making our documentary on Pierre Cardin, called House of Cardin at the time. And we said, well, you know what, let's get started. And hopefully, you know, we can kind of turn our attention to that next. And thank God we did, because actually Trini ended up, dying of COVID.
I did not
know
that. So
we had all of his life recorded, all of his stories kind of ready to go. We were supposed to show him a rough cut when he went in the hospital and died 10 days later.
Oh, dear. I did not know that.
So we're so happy that we have this legacy and that we're able to, you know, to let people remember who he really was. But documentary has been a very interesting direction as well. It started because Patty Schemmel, who is the subject of our movie Hit So Hard, which is about the grunge scene, the Seattle grunge scene. And Patty was a young girl, openly gay, and a drummer. And she happened to gig around town with a guy named Kurt Cobain, who took off and became the most famous rock star in the world. And Patty was the best drummer in town, and so everybody wanted her to be in their band. And she just started to, you know, travel and get to know everybody, and she ended up the drummer for Hole, for Courtney Love's band. And she happened to have a video camera. with her, and she filmed all of this incredible behind the scenes footage with her camera, and that was our first doc. She was a friend of ours. We knew she had a great story because we knew that she had ended up homeless on the streets of LA after having gone on that rocket ride of success, but we didn't know what had happened. So by doing the documentary, she told her story for the first time, and it was really kind of a heartbreaking and heart-wrenching story of survival, and that got us hooked on doing docs.
Now, where can we find these documentaries? Oh, you and your husband?
I say us because, yes, me and my husband, Todd Hughes, do a lot of our films and work together, yeah.
Well, I had a question that I was saying, and I don't remember what it is. You grew up in
Southern California. Oh, you asked me where could you find
these? Oh, yes, where can we find these documentaries?
So, Hit So Hard, the rights just recently reverted back to us, so we put it up onto Vimeo, and you can buy it on demand on Vimeo. My Name Is Lopez, which is just out, is on Apple TV and Amazon, and it's just come out on DVD as well. So it's kind of just released and available everywhere. All of our movies, if you look up Ebersole Hughes and documentaries, they all kind of pop up. House of Cardan is on every platform, and they're out there. Yep.
Now, you grew up in Southern California. How has that affected your creativity and your subject matter?
Well, you know, I think even just this sort of interest that I have in noir comes from having grown up under the Hollywood sign. I grew up at Beachwood. I don't know if you know L.A. well or not, but literally the Hollywood sign is above you. And the sort of dreams of success and desire to be able to participate in what might be the biggest American dream of all, which is, you know, becoming a star and being discovered, is something that happens to so few people, even though you're growing up right underneath it, that it kind of dovetails with that idea of noir, where when we believe that we cannot achieve through normal means, we think to ourselves, well, what if I crossed over to the dark side? And what if I said, well, look, working hard and, you know, being talented and putting my heart into things isn't getting me ahead. So, you know, maybe I should knock over a bank or, you know, do something untoward. So the kind of dream that lays over everything in Hollywood, I think, lends itself really nicely towards this idea of noir. And, the story takes place in L.A. to start with. They steal their fortune in L.A., but they run away to Palm Springs to hide out.
I was going to ask you about Palm Springs. Your part of the proceeds of your book go to a no-kill shelter in Palm Springs. You want to talk a little bit about that and your love of animals?
Yeah. You know, the story starts, I mean, that I was reading from chapter one, but the story, and that's a bit of a jump ahead. But when we flash back to the very beginning of the story, it begins over these two characters meeting with this main female character's dog having had cancer, and it metastasizes and the dog dies. That's a scene from my real life between me and my husband. We actually went to the UCLA Sculpture Garden for this poetic gesture before we had to put our first dog down, female pit bull. And that started our kind of lifelong desire to rescue lady pit bulls. And so we're on our fourth one now. And both of them, the two girls that we have right now, came from the Palm Springs Animal Shelter. It's a no-kill facility. And when my publisher asked me if there was anybody that I would like to, benefit from sales from the book, I just immediately said Palm Springs Animal Shelter. The girls kind of play a role in the book. They're the dog that dies at the beginning is sort of a mixed description of our first two dogs, Miss Killer and Butchie. And then Oopsie Daisy plays a role at the end as being kind of a symbol of hope. And she literally sat at my feet the whole time I wrote the book. Mm. So it was like Lucy wanting to be in the show. She kept saying to me, you know, aren't you going to put me in the book? I felt like she was saying to me. So I said, all right, I'll figure it out.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. Well, what are you currently working on?
Well, you know, between having a movie released and a book out, and then we also released an album. It's funny because, you know, my lead character is a frustrated pop singer, and then here I am at 58, and we just released a pop punk boy band record with friends. so I'm healing all my own childhood wounds as I'm going along. But we have that, and we have the soundtrack record for Trini Lopez. We have so many things coming to fruition and being released right now that we're kind of a little bit on pause towards the next project. But I do have an idea for, I don't know if I would call it a sequel or just kind of a continuing of ideas for a next crime fiction novel called 24 Hours from Tulsa, oh. Which is also a song title. It's a Gene Pitney song. It's similar in that it has this sort of what sounds like a cheery story to it, which is you think that he's singing about being just 24 hours away from the love that he's driving towards. But really what happens is that he gets 24 hours away from Tulsa, where his long lost love lives, stops into a motel, has an affair, and decides he's not going to make it. So he's saying to his beloved, sorry, I almost made it. I'm 24 hours from Tulsa, but I fell in love with somebody else.
That's the end of that.
So
yeah.
That fits into my, you know, lexicon of tragic love affairs. I think I can figure that one out as a basis for the next book.
Well, David, we have run out of time. I'm sorry, because I have more questions in my book. But is it Hughes Ebersol or Ebersol Hughes that people should be looking for?
Ebersol Hughes. The Ebersol Hughes Company is the name of our company. And EbersolHughes.com. is where you would find all the stuff about all our projects.
Okay, we've been talking.
And you know, you're in Minneapolis, correct?
Yes.
Because I'm doing a reading in Minneapolis on June 12th at Film North.
Okay.
Which is the one of the film societies there, and so we'll be in town then.
We'll get you on our calendar. We've been speaking with P.J. Ebersol, author of 99 Miles from L.A. What a wonderful interview this has been, David. Thank you so much for joining us on Right on Radio tonight, and have a wonderful day as we let you
Thank
go.
Thank you so much for having me on, Liz. Appreciate
you bet.
It.
You bet. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI, that's 90.3 FM, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. I'd like to thank our special guests from tonight, Kat Weaver, Emily Bergs-Leanne, and P. David Ebersol, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and more.